for the people. We're waiting for some of our members to get here from some other committees that are meeting, and there'll be some people that have to go back and forth. We are going to, in order, take House Bill 3549, which we're subsequently, hopefully, we'll be moving to revenue, and then the work sessions, and then we'll save the majority of our time for a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3000. So with that, we will open the public hearing on House Bill 3549. And with that, I'll have a short explanation, and then did you want to? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3549 would impose limits on property line adjustments. The bill also provides that property line adjustments are not considered a partition of land. There's no subsequent referral, no revenue impact, and we have not received a fiscal statement.
With that, we'll let Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly for the record, what we're attempting to do in 3549 is to fix a change that came out of a LUBA decision in late January, early February, and it's a technical fix. I think in the end there's still a few more technical fixes that may have to be amended out in revenue or subsequently, which I'm committed to work with. And I think each of the representatives can come forth and explain it. I think LCDC and counties and Thousand Friends are all here.
Okay. With that, we'll have the county people. Ron from DLCD first, I think, to begin with.
Yeah. You probably get the counties at the same time.
And the counties. So I think Polk County people are here, so they can come on up at the same time.
Excuse the essence, right?
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And House Bill 3549 comes out of a LUBA decision known as Phillips versus Polk County, which is, explains why Polk County is interested in it and its Representative Boquist's bill. Up until that decision, it was fairly clear that lot line adjustments were exempt from being treated as a partition of land, a land division. LUBA, looking at some of the language in the statute, decided that some lot line adjustments would be exempt and others would not and would have to be partitioned. So that sort of upset the apple cart, and it's important to understand this bill affects the interpretation of ORS 92, which is the land division statute, so it affects both cities and counties. So what this bill attempts to do is get back to where everyone thought the world was prior to that decision. And so Section 2 of the bill, in essence, tries to, and then Section 3, more clearly, the old definition mixed both a substantive and a procedural provision by saying that partitions exempted certain lot line adjustments. And what this bill tries to do is say, clearly, lot line adjustments are exempt from the partitioning statute, and then more clearly to spell out the types of lot line adjustments that are acceptable. So, for example, if you've got two parcels that start above the minimum lot size and you want to trade some acreage, and they both end up above the minimum, that's okay. If you're starting with two parcels less than the minimum, and you're trading some acreage and you end up with both of them below, that's okay. Where it gets more complicated is if you have two parcels, one above and one below, and you're just trading acreage. There's really effectively no difference, and this spells out in Section 2, Sub 2, that that's okay, and it would also allow that if you're starting with one above and one below and you end up with two above, that's okay as well. Where there is some, and you'll hear some concern about the bill and what happened actually in the Phillips case, is when one of those parcels has a dwelling on it and one does not, and you're reducing, and then the parcel with the dwelling is above the minimum lot size, and you reduce it below, and the adjacent parcel gets all that acreage and then qualifies for a dwelling, some see that as enabling additional development that ought to be not viewed as a lot line adjustment, which is a fairly routine procedure, and go through some sort of more closer review against appropriate land use standards. So the department supports the base bill as drafted. There are some proposing some amendments, and I think with conversations with the county and the other folks, I think we've got some general understanding and agreement, so we urge the committee to keep the bill alive and allow us to keep working on acceptable amendments. And with that, I'm available for questions, or let the county.
We'll let the county go, and then.
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, we were the county that was involved in this, but it basically could have been any county that this issue would have went to.
Be sure and state your name. Thank you.
Mike Probst, Polk County Commissioner. Sorry. It could have been any county that this particular issue would have went on to LUBA in this interpretation. And as our attorney looked at it, he said, yeah, this interpretation probably wasn't wrong of the law. It could have been interpreted this way, and it was something that obviously needed to be fixed, so we wanted to get together with the department and see if this could be, because it really doesn't work very well. And us being an agricultural and forest county, these type of lot line changes between farmers and foresters are done all the time, and this will affect the whole state of Oregon at some point in time, where they will not be able to do lot line changes, and it will have a major impact on this state, because that's a normal part of doing businesses by farmers and the forest industry. We have a lot of these come through. The piece that was mentioned about the residential, that is a minor piece that we can continue to work on to solve that in the bill. We're not too concerned that we can resolve that issue. But it's very important we get this resolved, because just in the period of time this was discovered, we've had numerous parcels that needed to do this in our county farm forests, and we have not been able to do it because it is just a normal part of business.
I'm Austin McGuigan. I'm the Community Development Director for Polk County, and I would just want to emphasize that this is absolutely critical, the ability to adjust common boundaries between resource parcels, and it's very common, and this has had a very large impact on property owners, particularly farmers in Polk County. So I support the base bill and urge the committee to move the bill.
Yes. If I might, Mr. Chair, one other point. Beyond the resource parcels, it's very common where you have buildings that are misplaced and are over a property line, and or it's been missurveyed, and people need to move and adjust that property line to resolve those differences. And with the way the court decision came, the LUBA decision came out, it's entirely possible that even some of those would not be possible in a city, in a rural residential zone or an industrial zone, where you need to make those adjustments.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The discussion is focused entirely on natural resource lands. Is that what ORS Chapter 92 does? Is that, are we only dealing with natural resource lands, or would this apply to other properties?
ORS 92 applies to all lands. It's the subdivision and partition provision in state law, so it impacts cities as well.
If I could.
Yes.
But then, I mean, the impact of the bill, as I understand it, is that if you have two properties, both of which are smaller than the minimum lot size, then you can go ahead and move the lot line between them so that one of them becomes even smaller in relation to the minimum than it would otherwise be. And I think I was hearing a rationale for that as applied to natural resource lands. Is the same rationale bear out for non-natural resource lands, let's say inside of a city, for example?
I can comment on rural lands that are in the county that are residential and not resource, and it's common that there are issues between property owners and disputes where they build a tree house and their neighbors, they thought the tree was on their property, they have it surveyed, it turns out it isn't, and they want to do a little adjustment with their neighbor to get the tree house on their property. I mean, that's something that we see often in the residential lands in the county that aren't necessarily in the city, and I can't speak for cities.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, and I can't speak for cities. as well, but I think Mr. McWiggin's situation is common, or it might be that there was a missed survey or houses over the line, and so you might have two parcels that are below the minimum, and yes, one is getting slightly or is getting smaller than the minimum, but then it's a trade-off. The other one is getting more conforming. It might not get over the minimum, or it might get over the minimum. But in, you know, the world is a complex place, and we create rules, and we have these lot sizes and parcels, and we need some flexibility to try and get those to be closer in alignment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Nope. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Is it Jen Just from Goal One? And Kate Kimball, Thousand Friends?
Good afternoon, Chair Roland, members of the committee. My name is Jim Just. I'm Executive Director of the Goal One Coalition, and we represented Phillips in the Phillips case. First of all, we don't think that there's anything that needs to be fixed. Property line adjustments aren't the only way to reconfigure properties. There's another process available, the replatting process under ORS 192, 180, and 185 is a simple and straightforward and cheap and inexpensive process. So LUBA's holding in Phillips was simply that because the property line adjustment process is set up to be a ministerial process where you really don't exercise any legal or policy judgment, that the circumstances under which there is no legal or policy judgment is pretty constrained, and the language of ORS 92.110.7b, which said that a property line adjustment that didn't involve conforming properties was not one of those circumstances. It was not one of those ministerial circumstances. That being said, we would support this bill with the amendments that have been worked on. So if those amendments were added to the bill, we would have no problem with it.
Thank you.
I'm sitting in a very tall chair, it turns out. For the record, my name is Kate Kimball. I'm staff attorney for Farm, Forest, and Ranch Lands at 1,000 Friends of Oregon. The basic point I want to make is the bill, as introduced, clarifies some of the basic housekeeping uses of the lot line adjustments. What it leaves out and what the amendments address is when they go beyond housekeeping, and you'll see in the back of my testimony, I use the diagram from the Phillips case. When those lot line adjustments are used to justify a new dwelling on farm and forest lands, we have concerns because that's not housekeeping, that's substantive, and we would like to make sure that distinction is maintained and use another process. And thank you for your time. I know you have a huge hearing after this.
Fine, thanks. Appreciate it. Any questions? Yes, Representative Boakley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just have, I guess, one question for both of them to make sure we're all in the same shooting music is, should the committee move it forward, the two of you, along with the counties and LCDC, is prepared to sit down and make sure we come to an agreement?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think we can just go with
the last day, or it was confusing.
The last two, Linda Ludwig and Bill, is it close?
Close.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I very much appreciate the work Mr. Eber and Polk County has done in bringing this bill forward today. However, I'm not an expert in the matter of this bill. I wish I was. I do have some concerns, as Representative McPherson raised, about how it would work with inside city limits. For instance, I immediately come up with a variant scenario. If a property owner was given a variance that ended up with a smaller lot, could they use the process here. I don't think the language yet sufficiently addresses that issue, but would very much like to work with this issue, continue on. Hopefully the bill will go to revenue, and we can make the changes that we think would be appropriate to address some of those concerns.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Close. I'm an attorney in private practice in Eugene. It's a pleasure to be here. I have been one of the members of Ron Eber's ad hoc rump committee, or a little circle of friends working on this bill. Haven't any discussions with legal Oregon cities yet. Anxious to welcome them to our circle of friends. I think we are at 95% to 98% of agreement on the details of this bill, depending on who you, on details of amendments needed to this bill, depending on who you ask. I have a letter pager. I have a bullet list there of the kinds of clients that I work for who do property line adjustments as a way of life. You have a bunch of farmers behind you, I think. They all do them. They have no appreciation for how important this bill is to them. Today they're here for something completely different. We're all on a fast curve here because this LUBA decision dropped on us in January, so everybody's scrambling to do a quick fix. The LUBA decision is on appeal at the Court of Appeals. I had the pleasure of writing the brief for that. We're all waiting for a decision, but, you know, waiting for a decision on this kind of an issue from the Court of Appeals is kind of like reaching into a Forrest Gump box of chocolates. What we really need is a comprehensive clarification of how you do property line adjustments. This bill is 95% to 90% of the way there, and we can get it tuned up in short order, I am sure. I think, Representative McPherson, you have a separate letter from a client of mine, the McKenzie River Trust. They're bullet number four on my list there. They're one of my clients. I do a lot of work for them as payback for all of the development work I do. And their letter to you says, we need to do property line adjustments in order to consolidate parcels into tracts that have the most valuable resources on them. So we're in line among the groups that need this bill, too. And if you don't have that letter yet, I'm going to turn it into the committee staff. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Belquist.
Just the same follow-up question I asked before, that both Linda and Bill are prepared to sit down in another work group as long as it's not island annexation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who did not sign up that would like to speak to House Bill 3549? Seeing none, we'll close the work session, the hearing on 3549, and we'll open a work session on 3549. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3549 with a due pass to revenue.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 3549 with a due pass to revenue, where we'll do some other work. Is there any discussion?
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I support this motion, and I have had experience with lot line adjustments. I have done one myself, and I know it's a fairly cumbersome process to go through. It's not one that doesn't involve a formal planning agency involvement. As introduced, I'd say the bill is pretty open as to what it allows, and I'd be looking for, in the ultimate version of the bill that comes to a floor vote, something that replaces what's probably an overly rigid standard in the statute now with something that isn't just open season on any kind of oddball configuration. But we do want to be practical about how we enable people to use their property.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a vote.
Representative Bowman?
Aye.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Dingbelman?
Excuse.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Chair Rowland.
Aye. The motion passes, and we'll send it on to revenue. Our next, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2760. And we've had a number of amendments to this bill. I think we're at number 13 or so. We're going to talk about 11. Okay. So we're going to have our administrator give a brief description, and then Representative Boquist will have a chance to respond as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Let's run down what House Bill 2760-11 is, the amendment that came out of the work group. It is a gut and stuff, so I will just run through all of what it does for you without comparison to the original version. The Dash 11 amendment creates a definition of creek. It authorizes a city to annex territory that is surrounded by the corporate boundaries of the city or by the corporate boundaries of the city and the ocean, shore, or river, creek, bay, lake, or interstate highway I-5 or I-84, but not a stream or other shallow or intermittent course of water, if the governing body finds substantial evidence that annexation facilitates efficient delivery of a municipal service in the territory. It does not apply to territory surrounded entirely by water or territory surrounded in part by a portion of the corporate boundaries of the city that consists of only a public right-of-way except I-5 or I-84, constituting more than 25% of the perimeter of the territory to be annexed. It requires the city to hold at least one public hearing for which notice has been mailed to each property owner in the area to be annexed. Unless otherwise required by charter, it requires that annexation be by ordinance or resolution subject to referendum. For properties zoned for and in residential use, it requires that annexation take effect 3 to 10 years after proclamation of annexation, unless the property is sold, in which case annexation would take effect immediately upon property transfer. It directs the city recorder to cause the clerk of the county that encompasses the annexed territory to record notice of delayed annexation within 60 days after the city proclaims annexation and to notify clerks of counties that encompass the city between 120 and 90 days before the annexation takes effect. It declares that the measure does not limit more restrictive city provisions for annexing territory. It applies to annexation and annexation ordinances or resolutions adopted on or after the effective date of this 2007 Act, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. That's all. That's all it does.
And that's the
that's the Dash 11 amendment, okay. Which had just a couple.
Just
that should be in here. I think he had so. Brian, did you hand out the Dash 11 or the 10? The Dash 11?
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm talking to the other Brian. Did you? So what? If you've got the Dash 10, it's almost identical to Dash 11, except that it clarified, it just references interstate highway, and the Dash 11 makes clear that it was only applying to interstate highways 84 and 5, which was Rhett McPherson's amendment.
Apparently, I thought interstate highway meant only I-5 and I-84, and then I understand there's some doubt about that. And so this is good. This is more constrained. So we have our two major interstates that are covered by it, but not other highways.
So I'll this is the 12.
Oh, I haven't seen the 12, and I'm not planning on introducing that one.
Okay.
I was not going to plan on introducing that one because this is the one that is this the one the committee.
This is the work.
Mr. Chair, there's at least 13 amendments there, I think. At a minimum, and I'm going to have to default to CAT as the concept of the Dash 11 is the closest one to the work group. Keep in mind, Mr. Chair, I don't think that you have what you would call a overall consensus. I think you have a negotiated or one of those bills in which not everybody is happy, and maybe no one's happy exactly, but no one's completely on the other side. And I would assume, even skimming through the Dash 11s, that this will have work to be done on the far side if it goes to the far side chamber, too. I know, as I said, there was a Dash 12 out there, but CAT is telling me that that's the Dash 11 is the closest one to the work group.
12 has consensus the same way 11 does. It takes away the substantial test, which we're advocates of further restricting annexation. It was on our behalf, and we felt that it was too vague, will lead to additional legal problems, and so we voluntarily wanted to remove out that part.
If I could, Mr. Chair,
yes.
go back to the Dash 11s, which is closer to being seem to have greater clarity, and it's the closest we've come to a consensus product.
Correct. 12 is just like 11, except it takes out the section around having a city also have to meet a finding by substantial evidence that the annexation would facilitate efficient delivery of services. we sort of looked at that and decided that's an extra hurdle on the city that really isn't going to be effective and really isn't necessary. And so we voluntarily decided that one should probably go.
So but it is the Dash 11s that don't have that in it.
No, they do have
Dash 12. Well, they do have that. So the Dash 12s is removes what is a kind of a vague or potentially troublesome extra hurdle or standard the cities would have to meet.
It also removes municipal services, includes public safety and urban services as defined by ORS 195-065.
Takes out the whole test of whether a city would have to prove they're going to give more urban services, because we felt it was not clear, substantial wasn't well defined, it would lead to problems for cities to have to prove it, and neighbors suing cities over an unclear standard.
Mr. I think you're going to have some testimony from, limited testimony, I believe, is that correct?
We can bring people up if we'd like.
We can fix it in the Senate if we have to.
I'm sorry, if I could ask, where in the Dash 11s does that standard that Representative Clem was describing appear?
Section B, Section 1, Part B, and Section...
Lines 13, 14, 15 particularly.
Yeah.
So it's got this sort of...
8, 9, 13, 14, 15.
I see.
It's got the traditional findings that he would have to go through. While we're waiting on that, the only other thing I'm not entirely thrilled about these is the I-84, because we heard some testimony about I-5 and what's happening there in particular, and I have no idea what might be occurring in I-84. I mean, my general belief about roads are they should be no more than 25% of the total island. So 75% of the island should be properties, and then that last remaining side should be a road and nothing beyond that. And that's, you know, I don't know how the map works out on I-84. I don't even know on I-5 it might only be 25% of the island, which they would be okay under that new threshold.
Depends on where the river and that road meet. Because now a river still works. This would...
Right.
It would treat it more like a river.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if I could, Mr. Chair, as I understand, the reason for having the 25% limit on use of roadways is so that we don't get what we might say artificial or manipulated annexations of just road right-of-ways to create encirclement, and you're not going to have that with an interstate highway because that's part of the interstate highway system. So I would think that the 25% just ought to operate independently of that use of the interstate highway system should be viewed the same way Willamette River is, or a major water course.
The problem for me is if the highway doesn't count against the 25%, then they do intentionally use another 25%. Now they can do really 50% potentially. I would rather have I-5, unless it's likely to be more than 25% as I-5, just be under the normal right-of-way rules, because they would still be okay under the 25%.
Well, I could, Mr. Chair. I think it could easily be more than 25% in a situation that would be quite logical to still recognize it as being like the river, because if you figure that it's on one side, and if you limited it to being 25%, then and went out, you would there's certain configurations of properties of areas that are adjacent to the freeway, kind of pinned in against it, that where the freeway might be, because it's longer and narrower as a stretch, might violate the 25% standard.
And do we know about 84? I mean, I could even go for leaving I-5 and taking 84 out, because I've heard no testimony at all about 84.
The only reason 84 is in there is because of I thought that was what we were including originally with interstate highways. I'm happy to remove I-84 if that would make people more comfortable with it.
Okay.
I would prefer that until I knew more about 84.
Okay.
You say it more politely than I say it.
So I need a motion.
You can accept the motion. You accept the 12 and then amend it, right?
Right. So, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 12 amendments with the conceptual amendment to delete the Interstate 84 to House Bill 2760.
Representative Clem has moved the dash 11s to House Bill
12.
Dash 12s to House Bill 2760 with the conceptual amendment to take out I-84. Did I get that right?
In two places.
I should probably look at the dash 12s. I don't seem to have here in front of me just to see what the text is we're looking at, but it sounds good to me.
I had the 12.
As a piece of information, Mr. Chair, my city, the city of Salem, wrote me in opposition to this bill on that portion that we're planning on now taking out. First, it would establish a high evidentiary standard for a city to conduct any island annexation. The city would have to show with, and at the time, originally, it was called clear and convincing evidence that annexation is necessary, so they didn't like it for that reason. We went down to substantial. It ended up not really helping, and that's why at this point we said, you know, let's just take it out. We can work on that in the future.
So let's have discussion on those while people have a chance to read it. So I do have some people who were in the work group who are not convinced that this is a good thing to do. So if that's the case,
I don't know if anybody.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Do you want to do it?
I'm going to talk to Nikki.
Good one.
I talked with all the work group people about 11, so I get a little concerned when I change something on people who were in that work group. For those people who haven't been involved in this has been going on for about a month and a half, and it took a bunch of bills about annexation and put them all together. There were a lot of people who showed up for the work groups, and we tried to get something that didn't harm.
Hey, Mr. Chair, 12 bills is what you gave me, for the record.
I know, that's true. 12 bills, that's right. I mean, I hate to do it. I mean, generally, I will not do it. Do you want to put the, we're going to do the 11s and then fix this over in the Senate? If not, I don't have to hear it.
Baker. Let me check this everywhere. I will see when I can. Nike's not bad.
The issue that I have is that now, how do you feel on this one, Brian? Okay.
I mean, Mr. Chair, the 12 is a watered-down version of 11, literally, and we could strengthen it back up on the Senate side if that's what turns out to be appropriate.
Yeah.
You were the person at the work committee. I have one person that's not real happy with that. If you want to look at that, Brian, you just know. And I made a commitment that what we would take out of the work group is what we would bring here, so that's what's hard for me.
Could you recess, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, let's
do a recess.
We can do that or close this one and come.
It's up to you. I mean, we have a lot of people here, so
we have a lot of other stuff we have to get to.
Right.
So let me close my work session on 2760, and we'll let some people work on that before I make a final decision. So there was, I can't do that. I have to take a recess. There's a motion on the table. I have to take a recess. Because there's a motion on the floor. So we have a motion on the floor to accept the dash 12s with the conceptual amendment to move out Highway 84.
And I need to correct myself that there's, I think I said the word consensus among the work group, which set off lots of fire bells. There isn't necessarily because some people haven't seen dash 12s. They've only now heard verbal characterizing of it. So okay. Let's retract my consensus phrasing.
Representative Oakley.
Mr. Chair, for the record, as a work group chair and still trying to keep some sort of consensus in the future, I'm sure Representative Edwards, who I'll speak for, and Representative Clem and I will work together on the Senate side to ensure we have passage of this in a consensus vote.
Okay. I will accept that. Any further discussion on the amendments? Any further discussion? Anybody opposed to including the dash 12s with the conceptual amendment of restriking the I-84 highway.
And Mr. Chair, I might just to clarify for the record, I sketched out what that would look like. It looks to me like on line 15 of page 1, we would need to add an or in front of Interstate Highway 5, and then delete on that same line or Interstate Highway 84. And then similarly, on page 2, lines 2 and 3, we would be deleting or Interstate Highway 84.
Yes, that's exactly what we have here as well. Okay, so that is the amendment before us. Anybody opposed to that amendment? Seeing none, the dash 12s are included. Next, I'll take a motion on the arrangement. Bill.
Chair, I move House Bill 2760 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. I don't think we have any subsequent referrals.
Representative Clem has moved that House Bill 2760 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I guess the only thing I would say is I will take the commitment of our people to make sure that they work this in the Senate if there's any problems with it. So with that being said, we'll do a roll call. Oh, yes.
I just want to, again, thank people for working on this issue. It really is going to help clarify some of the confusions around the use of streams versus water versus rivers versus roads and how much roads. Part of the problem with annexation is people really feel like there's not a good set of ground rules. And this bill will help significantly in clarifying the ground rules. Combine that with the other two bills we passed the other day. And then if people are annexed, this has a sort of safety valve where you get 3 years before the annexation takes an effect in an island situation to move or sell or plan for the taxes. And I feel very good about the package as a whole.
Okay, thank you very much. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Flint.
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Nyler.
Excuse.
Representative Smith.
Could I have an update on what we're voting on?
Yeah, 84 has been taken out.
Oh, it has?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Representative
Oakwood.
Aye.
Chair Robles.
Aye.
Motion passes. Representative Clem and Edwards, you want to carry this? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry for the last minute scurrying.
Hey, best to get it scurried and just get on with it. So we're going to close our work session on House Bill 2760. And we're going to look in the annexation. And we're going to move to
House Bill open a work session.
House Bill 3512. Short description.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3512 is the bill that creates the 11-member task force on agricultural workforce needs. There is a dash 2 amendment that I believe is Representative Clem's amendment that reworks one of the directions on what the task force will study related to the H-2A visa program.
So, Representative Clem. Yeah, why don't you just make a motion to accept these and then we can talk about them.
Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3512.
Representative Clem moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3512. Representative Clem.
Yes, thank you. The dash 2 amendments are a byproduct of Representatives Thatcher and, well, I think just Representative Thatcher actually came in the other day. Flores has also been involved. But it talks about having the task force, while it's taking a look at the larger issue of agricultural workforce needs and labor availability, to take a look at the H-2A visa program that does exist and the look at it generally, also look at the efficacy of the administration of the program by the Employment Department and see whether or not that program is working particularly well or not. I reworked the amendment a little bit to sort of leave a very neutral flavor to that study because there are people with strong feelings about whether it works well and most people don't think it works well, and then there's differing opinions on why. We didn't want to pre-disclose or pre-set for the task force that part. I ran this past Representative Thatcher and Flores. They're fine with this amendment, and so we felt that was sort of the right way to go forward to make sure it gets looked at, but not send a biased view of it from the committee without having a deeper conversation about that.
Okay. Mr. Discussion, yes.
Does this have a referral to Ways and Means? Or how come?
No.
Because it's a task force.
My
understanding. This is in the business committee, and a bill got referred to Ways and Means because it was a task force. So,
as a fiscal, as a fiscal, it's under 50,000. It usually isn't, but.
Yeah, I don't know.
One being different than the other.
Yeah, I can only say that we just had one in our other committee that came out at around 30,000. We didn't, so.
So what's the cost of this one?
We got to write now.
Maybe because Legislative Administration Committee is the one providing the staff support, and you know they've agreed to absorb it, and the task force members who are not members of Legislative Assembly are entitled to compensation, but I assume the rest of us are entitled. The other task force members are and were not, apparently. So maybe the dollar figure is real low because of the staffing and the fact that any of us on it aren't entitled to per diem. I don't know.
Well, I would raise that question and concern because I think in the legislature we should be consistent. We either do one way or the other. So
we
how are we supposed to know?
And have somebody from 11 come?
We can. We'll take a short recess and have somebody in LFO come. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other.
Well, you have another it doesn't mean, because I'm
my
bill
to answer the question.
My bill
doesn't end.
Besides these farmers who are waiting to talk about another issue, agricultural labor and workforce needs is probably one of the biggest things that we're dealing with today for the health of the agriculture industry. So I definitely want to get this thing moving and become law as soon as possible.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Dinkfeld.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Maurer. Excuse. Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Klemp.
Yes.
Chair Roland.
Aye.
Passes. And who would like to carry this one on the floor? Representative Klemp, you want to carry it? Okay, well, Representative Klemp.
Actually, no, Thatcher would probably like to. Co-carry it. Thatcher and I could co-carry it.
That's a possibility, too.
Yeah. We'll I'll check.
Next, we'll close the work session on 3512 and open a work session on 3481. And we'll have a short description.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3481 is the bill that dealt with the rotation cycle for harvesting timber on lands not eligible for a special assessment, poplars. There is a -5 amendment in front of you, which replaces the original bill. It creates a 7-member task force appointed by the Speaker and Senate President to study issues related to the poplar industry. If you take a look at the -5 amendment, the study direction is provided on lines 19 through 21. The amendment also requires the group to report back to an interim committee no later than December 1st of 07, and also directs the Department of Forestry provide staff support to the task force as much as is practicable.
So does this one have a subsequent referral?
All these task forces.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it does have a subsequent referral to revenue, but with the -5 amendments, it would not go to revenue. The original bill needed to go to revenue.
Right. This one would have to go to Ways and Means if it has a
yes.
cost. Same. I will say that the reason that I'm concerned about the previous one we sent and not this one, we just had a discussion in education about a 7-minute board would be under the $50,000 threshold. So this is small enough that I think would meet that threshold. But I will ask the Speaker to consider this one the same way.
Mr. Chair.
But I will remove the revenue request. Yes.
Yeah, if I might, we actually stripped out any option for anyone to get compensation or reimbursement,
okay.
including the volunteers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it shouldn't cost anything.
So I was in a motion.
Mr. Chairman, -5 amendments to House Bill 3481.
Representative Klemm moves the -5 amendments to House Bill 3481. Any discussion? Seeing none. Anyone opposed? Seeing no one, we'll put the stash buys into this bill. Yes.
Never mind.
You can do it on the next motion.
I move House Bill 3481 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 3481 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yes, Representative.
Just to remind folks, this is a task force basically with folks from the hybrid poplar industry, folks from the Forest Industry Council, Small Woodlands and Farm Bureau to kind of take a look at the issues around taxation and regulatory practices of poplars to see whether or not, you know, they are more tree or more crop. We've decided we're going to take a look at that this summer. We report back by December 1st of 2007 with hopefully will be some sort of common ground around how that should be treated.
So part of the discussion would be that in the special session, we'd have a chance to even move something.
That's the hope.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
Only Mr. Chair, I mean, it's a great deal. It's like being in the military. It has forced volunteerism in it.
Representative Dingfelter, did you have a question?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
It's about the fiscal, which has been answered.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote on House Bill 34. Mm-hmm. What's the number?
81.
81, as amended.
Representative
Myler
excused. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative Dingfelter?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
Motion passes, and we will close our work.
Sure.
Pardon?
I was going to recommend that we put on the consent calendar.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea, too.
Oh, yeah. We have to go back. We're still in the work session. We do need to rescind the subsequent referral to revenue. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I will make a motion to rescind the referral to revenue for House Bill 34E1 as amended.
Okay. Representative Dingfelter moves that we rescind the referral to House revenue. Thank you. Any discussion on that? Do we need to take a roll call? Anyone disagree with that? No? It passes. And now we'll put a motion
to put it on the
consent calendar. Anyone disagree with that? We'll put it on the consent calendar. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3481.
We'll call it in.
Now, there were a couple of bills, votes that were missed. Are there people who would like their record? If anybody, I think everybody else is here, so we're okay.
I think that was her.
So,
she's leaving.
With that,
doesn't matter.
We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3000. And you also have a bunch of extra material. You'll talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3000 would prohibit open field burning, stack burning, pile burning, and propane flaming. The bill requires registration for open burning of agricultural waste. The bill further establishes the open burning management account and continuously appropriates money into the account of DEQ for the smoke management program. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. There is a fiscal impact statement in your package. The bill may have a revenue impact, but we have not received that yet. You also should have in front of you a stack of testimony that's been received both for and against the bill. And I also have a three-ring binder that I'll pass around the table that Representative Holvey has provided. And if at any point you'd like copies of the material in that notebook, just let us know.
Okay, and we have designed this because we knew we had an amount of time for 20 minutes for people for the bill and 20 minutes for people who were against the bill. Currently, we're waiting on Representative Holvey to get here. He was chairing another committee that was going on at the same time, so he should be down in a moment, and he asked to be with that group at the beginning. So we're going to take a short recess while we wait for Representative Holvey on House Bill 3000. Representative Holvey. We had to let our Representative Smith go to be your co-chair to go back up so you could get back down. We knew there was a She headed up real quick. She said
she should be done now.
Okay. She'll be back then.
Thank you for your patience. I request permission for visual aids.
No problem. And do you have other people who want up the table with you right now, or do you want to wait?
Well, I think they'll come up after I'm
done. Okay.
If they may. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing House Bill 3000. Originally, this bill prohibits open field burning, stack burning, pile burning, and propane flaming. It did allow for open burning of agricultural waste under permit and authority of the Department of Environmental Quality. The bill also establishes the smoke management program and the open burning management account under the authority of the DEQ. I do have Dash 1 amendments. Hopefully you got them in time to look at them. I'll talk to those a little bit later in my testimony as to how they actually change this bill. They were meant as a compromise that I worked out with input from a few other people. I provided each of you with a packet of information. In this binder, you will find information about fine particulate matter and its impact on health, as well as information about alternatives that growers can already use. I will reference many of these documents in this packet. I introduced this legislation because of the extreme threat to public health of Oregonians as a result of agricultural field burning. Since introducing House Bill 3000, I have heard from thousands of individuals across the state, many organizations, all in support of eliminating field burning. Amongst those organizations are the Lane County Medical Society, the Oregon Medical Association, the American Lung Association of Oregon, the Oregon Lung Specialists, the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, the City of Eugene, and the Lane County Board of Commissioners. There is clear and convincing scientific evidence that both long-term and short-term exposure to fine particulates in smoke have significant adverse human health effects. The emissions from field burning grass residues contain a mixture of solid and liquid particles, which include particulate matter, carbon monoxide, methane, and toxics like acetaldehyde, acrolein, benzene, butadiene, formaldehyde, methyl chloride, toluene, and xylene. The particulate matter is both large coarse particulates and fine particulates. Unlike the coarse particulate matter, fine particulates lodge deep in the lungs, and the body's defenses are unable to remove them. Toxics from the emissions recombine and attach to these fine particulates. To realize how detrimental smoke and fine particulate matter is to human health, one need only look at the extensive scientific research. The Journal of American Medical Association states that even short-term exposure to fine particulate air pollution has been found to increase the risk for hospital admissions for cardiovascular and respiratory ailments. A study done in Washington State notes that epidemiological evidence, stumble on that one, has established a clear link between small airborne particles and health, particularly for an at-risk population comprising people with existing pulmonary conditions such as asthma, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, or heart disease. The EPA found in a fact sheet about fine particulate matter states that many scientific studies have found an association between exposure to particulate matter and a series of significant health problems, including aggravated asthma, chronic bronchitis, reduced lung function, irregular heartbeat, heart attack, and premature death in people with heart or lung disease. Statistics used to track these impacts, such as hospitalization rates for asthma, fall short of tracking the full impact. Hospitalization rates only capture one visit per person, even if the same person comes in multiple times. Cite asthma as the primary diagnosis, even though we know that other cardiovascular and respiratory problems like bronchitis can result and do not include visits people make to their doctor. Beyond these statements and data, there have been deaths in both Idaho and Washington that have been directly linked to exposure to field-burning smoke, not to mention numerous traffic deaths and accidents caused by smoke. In your packet, Exhibit E, you will find an affidavit from Henry D. Cavelli, MD. In this affidavit, he states that he has witnessed the immediate death of one patient who was exposed to field burning and experienced immediate respiratory difficulty and expired as a result of an exacerbation of his disease. In your packet, I have also included an article, Fields of Fire, which talks about one specific death from field burning smoke. I think it is also important to briefly talk about the effectiveness of smoke management and monitoring of the emissions from field burning. Smoke management is intended to burn when conditions are favorable and directing the smoke plumes away from the more densely populated areas. However, smoke management and conditions are not always predictable. This practice means that many of our smaller communities are literally designated as sacrifice zones. The measurements data and standards used by both the EPA and the DEQ are very site-specific and most often based on averages that do not reflect the extremely high levels that much of our population is being subjected to. And frankly, our smaller communities do not breathe averages. Studies show that the smoke and fine particulate matter from field burning is a problem. But just how big of a problem is it? Throughout this debate, you have heard and will probably hear again today that field burning contributes only 2% of the particulate pollution in the Willamette Valley annually. You have to be careful when looking at this statistic. First, directly after citing the 2% statistic, the DEQ states that occasional short-term particulate sources such as field burning or prescribed field burning can have adverse health impacts on the public, especially sensitive groups like asthmatics. More importantly, though, this statistic uses coarse particulate matter when calculating emission totals. But as I noted earlier, fine particulate matter is what causes the most harm. When one looks at fine particulate matter pollution from field burning, a different picture emerges. During the season when growers burn their fields, Exhibit H in your packet and on this chart, they produce 40% of the total fine particulate matter in the Willamette Valley. On the 4 days when about half the total acreage is burned, open field burning produces 64% of the total fine particulate matter in the Willamette Valley. To put these numbers in perspective, mobile vehicles and equipment, the cars you and I drive, produce only 6% during the entire field burning season and 4% of the total fine particulate matter pollution on the largest four burning days. To get the equivalent amount of pollution from vehicles on those four largest burning days, we would have to increase the number of vehicles on the road by a factor of 16. Another way to look at the scale of pollution is to examine the aggregate total of pollutants that are produced. Over the course of the 2006 field burning season, growers produced almost 13,000 tons of pollutants by burning. On the four biggest burning days in 2006, growers produced more than 770 tons of fine particulate matter, 4,885 tons of carbon monoxide, and more than 676 tons of toxics like benzene and formaldehyde. During those 4 days, the amount of carbon monoxide generated from burning equaled half the yearly amount produced by the largest smokestack polluter in the southern Willamette Valley. These statistics show that field burning smoke is not just a minor contributor of pollution in the Willamette Valley. When we combine these numbers with the scientific evidence about short-term exposure, it becomes apparent that field burning is a major threat to public health in Oregon. Thus far, I've spoken to you about how field burning impacts a person's health and how much pollution is created and monitored. Now I want to examine how reducing and eliminating open field burning has impacted growers and discuss the available alternatives that many growers are already utilizing. Today, growers can burn up to 65,000 acres, but in 2006, they burned about 49,000 acres. That is less than 10% of the total acres of grass seed grown in Oregon today. As you will see from this chart in Exhibit N in your packet, since the legislature began limiting the amount of acreage that can be burned, the total number of acres grown in the Willamette Valley has increased from roughly 375,000 in 1991 to just under 500,000 acres today. Sales have increased even more, with sales reaching $481 million in 2006. That is more than double the total sales of $175 million in 1991. Pounds of seeds harvested have also increased from $565 million to $810 million. This story is not unique to Oregon, since eliminating the practice of grass seed burning in Washington State, yields of grass seed and legume production have increased by almost 50% from 500 pounds per acre to 740 pounds per acre. Production has increased from 250,000 CWTs to 350,000 CWTs, and the value of production has increased from $17.5 million in 1998 to $28 million in 2006. In addition to these benefits to seed growers, if you turn to Exhibit N, researchers in Washington State found that eliminating field burning made good public health policy, with probable benefits totaling $8.4 million versus $5.6 million in probable costs. And they were dealing with around 60,000 acres. The grass seed industry is not the only industry impacted by field burning. Among the complaints I have received have been from people who bring friends and family to Oregon only to have their trip ruined by smoke from field burning. Oregon's tourism industry depends on our natural resources and outdoor activities to attract visitors to our state. These tourism activities contribute more than $6 billion in direct travel spending to the state. Oregon's wine tourism industry, an industry impacted by field-burning smoke, is a growing segment of the market that contributed $95 million to our economy in 2004. These numbers do not show an industry ruined by not burning. Rather, they show an industry that has successfully adapted and developed economically viable alternative methods of managing residue. Research has shown that burning is not needed to preserve yields in many types of grasses grown in Oregon. Looking at Exhibit O, it reads that Chastain in 2000 found that growing cool season perennial grass seed crops without open field burning did not reduce seed purity or germination in trials conducted over a 6-year period in Oregon. Oregon has invested millions of dollars on tax credits to develop sustainable alternatives to field burning. Among these alternatives that growers are using and can use are removing and baling straw for resale, retaining grass seed residue on the field as compost or animal feed, planting alternative crops like meadow foam, and using residue as an ingredient in the production of cellulosic ethanol. Post-harvest grass seed residue is a valuable commodity for growers. This straw can be baled and removed to be sold as livestock feed or as a way of protecting against soil erosion on fields, roadsides, and on hills following the forest fires. Since reducing the acreage that can be burned, growers have taken advantage of this market opportunity, and today Oregon exports 650,000 tons of straw with sales values of $65 million to countries throughout Asia. Second, growers can retain straw on their fields using a process called full straw management. Full straw management is a common practice that is already being utilized by many growers throughout the southern Willamette Valley. This method returns valuable nutrients and moisture to the soil, protects against erosion, and helps fight against weeds. As noted earlier, research has shown that full straw management does not reduce yield or purity for many types of grasses grown in Oregon. Third, growers can rotate their grass seed crops with alternatives like meadow foam. Meadow foam seed oil is a valuable commodity that has a variety of applications in the $27.1 billion cosmetics industry and industrial uses as a lubricant. Looking at in your packet in Exhibit Y, you can also see the meadow foam has additional benefits for growers in fighting weeds and preserving moisture in the soil. For growers, meadow foam is also grown in another season than grass seed, and most of the equipment used to harvest the plant is the same used in the grass seed, meaning that farmers can grow it with a minimum of new investment and intrusion with other scheduled growing. Lastly, as Oregon and the United States face an era of rising energy consumption, uncertainty about supply, and increasing environmental awareness, grass seed straw represents a valuable commodity for conversion to cellulosic ethanol. Recognizing this energy future, President Bush has called on the United States to reduce oil imports by more than 75% by 2025. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has stepped up to meet this goal, doubling funding research for cellulosic ethanol. Oregon is ready to meet the cellulosic ethanol challenge. With more than 1 million tons of post-harvest grass seed produced each year, roughly 500,000 of which is burned or retained on the soil, Oregon has the raw ingredients for production. In fact, a report by the Oregon Department of Energy, Exhibit Z in your packet, found that Oregon grass straw residues are well suited for conversion to ethanol when combined with the alternative tax credits available to growers to find alternatives. Production becomes attractive and feasible. I have introduced an amendment to House Bill 3000 that you should each have a copy of before you. This amendment basically eliminates the grass seed field burning in the southern end of the Willamette Valley or in the Willamette Valley and allows an exception for steep terrain grass seed, specifically in the Silverton Hills. It also allows, by permit, the burning of other fields throughout the rest of the state. Agricultural burning of such items as mint stubble and Christmas tree residue would be allowed with a permit issued by the DEQ. The amendment also creates standards to fine particulates to be recognized by the Department of Environmental Quality to establish those burning permits, and needs to be in agreement with the Department of Human Services for its impact on public health. Given that this information is available and known, I believe it is incumbent on the state of Oregon to end the unnecessary practice of field burning. Whether it is accomplished by the executive branch, the legislative branch, or the judicial branch, it needs to happen. And I believe it would be negligent of this legislature or the executive branch not to end field burning this year. Mr. Chair, I just appeal to my colleagues that this practice, having researched this and the information that's become available, that the pollutants are causing great harm to thousands of residents in the southern end of the Willamette Valley. And I believe our farming industry, I believe that the state of Oregon needs to take off the blinders and look at the amount of pollution, the amount of fine particulates specifically. I'm not talking about coarse particulates. I'm talking about the fine particulates that are sending people to hospitals, costing people thousands of dollars in medical costs. It's very well known, as documented from other states and studies, that it is a serious problem, that it does cause health effects, and I believe we have the technology available in the industry to grow without burning. Mr. Chair and Committee, I hope that you do take action on this bill and move it forward. I will continue working on this issue with people from the industry and people in the governor's office and this legislature to address fine particulates in this state. I appreciate the time and the opportunity to talk.
Thank you. Any questions for
Representative? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Thank you. Just two quick clarifications. You mentioned one of the amendment. It covered environmental waste. Does that include the burning of diseased trees that Department of Agriculture requires now, for example, from nursery plants and stuff?
Yes, I think in the amendment, the only thing that is eliminated is the grass seed burning in the Willamette Valley, and all other burn, and with the exception that I allow for the steep terrain grasses to be burned, but all of it is done through a waiver or permit through the Department of Environmental Quality, and also recognizing that they need to set standards for fine particulates in this state.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Help me out in legislative terms. Fine particulates. I was looking for a good, like, three-line definition in here, and obviously grass burning covers that. Does wood smoke or fugitive dust or prescribed forest burns, can you give me a layman's term of fine particulates?
Fugitive dust is not a fine particulate. It's a coarse particulate for the most part. Fine particulates are defined as 2.5 micrograms per cubic meter, whereas a coarse particulate is 10 micrograms per cubic meter. It's pretty dang small. It's so small that your lungs can't expel it. And that's really why it's such a huge health impact, is because it goes into your body, it stays in your lungs, and gets into your blood system. And when those fine particulates attach with the toxics that are also emitted into the air, it becomes even a worse health problem.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Holding. I know you've done an amazing amount of work on this bill. Can you just remind me what is the policy in our surrounding states, state of Washington, Idaho?
The state of Washington does not allow grass seed burning since 1998. They have eliminated it. The state of Idaho does not allow agricultural burning at all. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal ended agricultural field burning in the state of Idaho. And I really fear that, unless this body or this state becomes proactive in putting some regulation and sidebars around fine particulates in this state, our agricultural industry could be in danger of losing burning altogether.
Mr. Chair, actually, that triggered a thought. I was having a conversation with someone the other day about Washington, and they said that something is burned there in fields, 100,000 plus acres, and I had been under the impression from every other conversation that field burning was banned, but apparently that's not right. It's just grass seed.
It's just grass seed. They still burn wheat straw. Grass seed burning produces a lot more, and I don't have the statistic, but it was I believe it was 8 times more. But don't quote me on that. I can give you that later. Emissions than does wheat straw stubble. And I know there's a couple other people.
Yeah, Andy Ginsberg, Victor Hill, and Holly Higgins. We have about 5 minutes. We aren't counting your questions and answers on that one, so we'll give you 5 minutes for these three.
I'll be fast.
Be sure to
Mr. Chair, effect. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I was asked to give a little background information on House Bill 3000. I'll be very brief. In 1975, the legislature adopted a smoke management program for the Willamette Valley that was operated at that time by the Department of Environmental Quality. The limit was 250,000 acres per year burned. They were actually burning about 205,000 acres then. In 1988, there was an accident on I-5 involving multiple cars and fatalities that was attributed to decreased visibility from fuel burning. And following that, the legislature adopted a phase down of fuel burning. In 1991, 180,000 acres was the limit, down to 40,000 acres in 1998, and then we had an exemption, 25,000 additional acres for certain exempt species. At that time, the program was also transferred to the Department of Agriculture. And now actual burning over the last 5 years has averaged about 50,000 acres per year. Burning is managed by the Department of Agriculture and their smoke management program. The idea is to burn on days when ventilation will take the smoke away from populated areas. Oregon has a very well-respected program within the West, and it works very well. Although on occasion there are smoke impacts whenever you're dealing with the weather, obviously you may miss call. But when there are impacts, generally they're short-term, although occasionally we will have smoke settle in overnight and then it will dissipate in the morning. As Representative Holby mentioned, fine particulate is the pollutant of most concern. For every acre burned, approximately 69 pounds of fine particulate is emitted. Over the course of the year, field burning is a relatively small source of fine particulate in the Willamette Valley, about 3% of total emissions. But as Representative Holby said, during the field burning season, it can be as much as 40% of emissions. And on days when burning is actually occurring, it can be higher than that. But you need to keep in mind that burning occurs on the days when there's the best ventilation, so you can't just look at the total emission number on itself. It doesn't directly correlate with exposure. And in fact, the idea is to do all of the burning on only a few days when we have the optimal ventilation conditions. EPA has recently tightened the fine particulate standard, and we're very focused on it. Now we will have two areas of our state that are violating the standard, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls. However, field burning is not the primary cause of the problem. The violations typically occur in the winter time, whereas field burning is in the summer. We also have the standard set by EPA looks over a 24-hour average period, and typically field burning impacts are shorter term than that.
Nevertheless, as Representative Holby said, there are health effects from short-term exposures to fine particulate, but we don't have federal standards to address them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll go on to the next, because we've only got a couple more minutes.
Hi, yes. My name is Holly Higgins, and I live in Harrisburg. Actually, I'm here to say that the Oregon Department of Agriculture smoke management system isn't working for the 50,000-plus rural Oregonians who breathe enormous amounts of smoke during the summer and fall. This program's strategy is to minimize the smoke impact to the public. So for where we live, that means Eugene and Springfield. But what that does is it actually maximizes the impact to rural Oregonians. My family and I live on Mount Tom, which is in the Harrisburg area. And from mid-July through October, often several times a week, for several hours at a time, we breathe the smoke from the burning of grass seed fields. And this isn't a mistake. This is where the smoke is designed to go, rather than more populous areas, rather than Eugene and Springfield. And again, there's at least 50,000 rural Oregonians that are in the same situation. The DEQ's fact sheet on the smoke management program even acknowledges that reality. And I'll just quote briefly. Currently, the state's smoke management program affords greatest protection to the Willamette Valley's major population centers, but often lesser protection to some smaller population areas. And I would just like to add that lesser protection is not correct. I called the ODA last summer, and they told me that whenever there is a westerly wind, they will burn. So that means the smoke comes to our area. And we're at a higher elevation, so often the smoke stays 8 to 10 hours at a time. And that's considered a good burn because it didn't go into Eugene Springfield. So this is just one example on our end of the valley. I know someone from Mill Valley, they also Mill City, the other end of the valley, they get a lot of smoke too. And last summer it was so thick, it set off their high school's fire alarm. So again, in closing, there's at least 50,000 rural Oregonians who are significantly impacted by the burning of grass seed fields in the summer and the fall. And the smoke management program has been tasked with minimizing the public impact from that smoke. And so how many rural Oregonians will it take before we're considered part of the public? Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and please support House Bill 3000.
Thank you. In a couple minutes.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Victor Hill, and I reside in Salem. I support House Bill 3000, sponsored by Representative Paul Holby. I'm a retired Air Force meteorologist, and I've been active in professional meteorology and air quality work for over 30 years. The professional opinions I express today are my own, and based on some of my testimony is my academic and professional training and years of experience in meteorology and air quality. My background include undergraduate studies in chemistry at Portland State, bachelor's degree in professional meteorology and computer science, as well as master's degrees in computer science and meteorology, and a year of, recently of postgraduate study in agricultural air quality. Considering the subject of House Bill 3000, namely addressing the impacts of field stubble burning in Oregon, it is my carefully considered professional opinion that notwithstanding the reasonable efforts to use the best available meteorology, the newest air quality modeling tools, and with careful consideration for climatology, up-to-the-minute weather data, and other local factors, the magnitude and the intensity of the pollution produced primarily and secondarily from field burning smoke plume negatively impacts Oregon residents. The 2% number for the annual emissions has been used. Why is this 2% statistic the wrong number to consider when addressing air quality impacts with regard to field burning? It's a long-term average. The annual average masks the harsh impacts of field burning episodes that sharply spike the local pollution levels. One of the challenges is to capture an accurate report how intense the local pollution is during field burning episodes. But where are these sensors located? They're located in the urban areas. And by plan, the field burning pollution is directed away from the populated areas, and therefore they are not reported accurately in any great detail.
You need to wrap up fairly quickly.
Sir.
Thanks.
On page 3 and page 4 are two examples of where a field burning was captured by a sensor in Idaho in 2005, and this is from previous testimony in the Idaho case that I presented under oath. showing a maximum of 550 micrograms per cubic meter on the one-hour average and on a 24-hour, and that is 15 times greater than the current EPA 24-hour standard. And on the 24-hour average for particulate matter, fine particulate matter, it was 87.3, which is 2.5 times the 24-hour. So when you do catch a plume, it is very sharp contrast to what we hear on annual or averages. So thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome to my home during. You're all welcome to come to my home during field burning season if you want to see what it's like.
Thank you. One question before you go. Yes.
Andy. Just to clarify the record so I understand it, because I'm looking at a Department of Agricultural document that I think Representative Holden may have given us, and it indicates here that Washington does, in fact, burn 150,000 acres, that in addition, 78,000 acres of grass seed is burnt on Indian reservations, i.e., the burning migrated to Indian reservations. That's one question. The follow-up to that is to make sure I understand, at least what I'm looking at, says that while Idaho has not banned, the federal court has put an injunction against Idaho until they complete an air plan, and that Idaho is planning on completing that air plan. Can you give me any background on that?
If I could start with the second question first. Idaho is caught up in a legal quirk right now. Their current federally approved plan doesn't allow field burning, and my understanding is it was inadvertent, and they are attempting to fix that, but they can't allow burning until after they revise their state rules, and then that's approved by the federal government, which can take quite a while. And I'm not really that familiar, Mr. Chair and Representative Boquist, I'm not really that familiar with the field burning programs in the other states, but my understanding is that Washington does allow some burning. I believe they banned some forms of grass seed burning, or maybe all of it, but they do allow other types of agriculture burning. It'd probably be better to get someone from the Department of Agriculture to answer that question.
One follow-up question. Very
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a layman's definition of fine particle again? We're talking wood stove smoke, or are we talking prescribed forest burns? I mean, it's great to talk the deals, and I understand grass seed burning, but what other examples are out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that's your examples are correct. It's I think of the difference typically as smoke as fine particles and dust as coarser particles, although there's a little overlap there. Dust can be ground up fine enough to count as fine particles, but it's mostly things that are burned. So it's wood stove, open burning, grass seed burning, forestry burning, all of those things are fine particles.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We have a group of people, Dave Nelson, Gordon Zielinski, Derek Schumacher, Ralph Fisher, Bob Schaefer, and Eric Bowers, and however you want to work yourselves, that'll be fine.
Three at a time, Mr. Chair.
That'd be great. And just another answer to your fine particulate. Flour in the right conditions is fine particulate. And some of these big, when they have grain elevators and stuff, every once in a while some of the grain will get so small that it becomes fine particulate. So
it also blows up. It's explosive.
It does get explosive as well. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council. It's a position I've been in since 1975. Prior to that, I was the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Farm Bureau. So I've lived through a lot of years of discussion of field burning and of a number of other issues before this body. Let me quickly, and I'm giving you another stack of information that let me call attention to a couple of items in that. First, in doing my rough calculations on my cell phone calculator, I came up with 1,700 tons of particulate, not 12,000, that comes off grass seed fields, as Representative Holby indicated. First, the grass seed industry is a collection of grass seed farmers who are throughout the Willamette Valley farming about 500,000 acres, 535,000 acres in the state. 485,000 of that is here in the Willamette Valley. A lot of that turned to grass seed because AgriPac went bankrupt about 15 years ago, and Bird's Eye food processing plant in Woodburn closed its doors, and so those farmers moved to grass seed production as kind of a last ditch. Let me point out that since my colleagues will talk about the impact of the reduction in fuel burning. We think we've been doing very well, frankly, in reducing burning from 250,000 acres a year. Actually, it was 320,000 acres in 1972, and we're down to less than 50,000 acres that's actually burned during the course of the year. We've worked very hard to be successful at doing that, and as you all know, the first 90% is usually the easiest in accomplishing something, and the last 10% is the hardest. Let me call your attention to a few items in here in this packet that are, I think, play into the discussion that you've been having or that you've been hearing. First, if you turn to this this fold-out page, it's an article in the Capital Press, and I've highlighted some of what was you just left the last witnesses on, and the statement was that farmers are doing well in Washington and Idaho. And as Representative Boquist correctly noted, that's because more than 30,000 acres of grass seed, bluegrass production moved over to the Coeur d'Alene Indian Tribe Reservation and the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. And if you look at that last paragraph in the third column down there, something that we have worked hard in Oregon to avoid, and that is the statement that most of the Rathdrum Prairie, which was once the primary bluegrass production region in the Northwest, is now a subdivision. And so we try not to go there, but nonetheless, we're in exclusive farm use zones, and we need to be allowed to continue to farm. Also then included a chart for you of burning in comparable in the surrounding states. In Oregon, you see our burning is about 50,000 acres a year. California, about 70,000 acres. That's rice and barley and wheat. Washington, about 150,000 acres. That's wheat and what's called CRP planting, which a lot of grass seed, dryland grass seed production in the Columbia Basin moved to conservation reserve planting under the federal farm program, which is frequently and regularly burned by the grower, and that's grass. That's not wheat or anything. It's grass, and grass burns like grass, and so that's a lot of grass burning in Washington. Also, as Mr. Ginsburg correctly pointed out, the Idaho situation was simply a technical situation where EPA was trying to amend their state implementation plan for Idaho and were sued by some environmentalists saying you did not do the arithmetic in offsets properly and therefore you can't do the amendment until you get that offset done. If you then look at the page that is about three pages back called the EPA, the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, and if you find that page in the middle of that first paragraph, you see primary standards. Primary standards, these are standards established by the Environmental Protection Agency to protect public health, including the health of sensitive populations. So the EPA has established standards for particulate matter that is 2.5 microns in diameter or less. And then I'm going to lead you back and to a page called Figure 3, which is the third page of a letter to Representative Polvey, which traces, it looks like Mount St. Helens jiggle chart, but it traces the air quality in Eugene and Springfield and also in Corvallis. And you see that Eugene and Springfield, during the months that we burn, which are July and August, a very little amount in July, the most in August, are below the standards that protect human health, including sensitive populations. So the chart that Representative Holvey showed you is simply what is the distribution within that fraction that's below the standard. It doesn't say it's deadly. It says it's the distribution of the fraction that's below that standard level. And if you go on to the Department of Agriculture's report, and this is, I should have numbered these pages for your convenience because it is a little tacky to kind of try to take you through that. Go through the impact hours, which is about the fourth page from the fifth or sixth page from the back. Looks like that. It says an impact hours chart. And this is measured by instruments that are placed around the Willamette Valley to measure air quality impacts by the Department of Environmental Quality. that said we have 1 hour of heavy impact, and that occurred in Corvallis, and I know the field that was burned, the day that it was burned, and the farmer who burned it and ran that plume of smoke right through Corvallis, and that was just a bad burn all the way through. There were 11 hours of moderate impact, and there were 16 hours of light impact. Now, what are those impact? What does it relate to? An hour of heavy impact is where visibility is approximately 5 miles or less, as measured by a nephelometer. A moderate impact is when the visibility is reduced from 5 to between 5 and 12 miles of visibility, and a light impact of 16 hours is when visibility is reduced somewhat, but not below 12 miles visibility. I think that you and I would think that a 12-mile visibility was a pretty good day on many days. Finally, before my colleagues take off, I'd like to have you look at the last page. This is out of the Oregon Asthma Surveillance Report for dated March 2007. It's the very last page in the packet. You'll see on the month that we burned the most fields, we have absolutely the lowest number of asthma-related hospitalizations. Now, that's a key, that's a bellwether indicator, a bellwether number, because other respiratory illnesses tend to trace that same number, maybe different numbers, but they tend to trace it the same. So you see the highest incidence of asthma-related problems occur in January, February, March, April, and so on. The lowest is in the month of the greatest atmospheric dispersion, which is August. We burn the most in August. Our impact is obviously very, very low. We'd have very low, or else you'd see a much higher incidence of impact there. I'd like to introduce Gordon Zielinski, who's Vice President of the Scotts Company, and he can talk about what's happening in grass seed production and quality.
I might correct you, Dave. I'm Sales Director of the Scotts Company's Professional Seed Division, and I deal both domestically and internationally, and I'm the current President of the Oregon Seed Trade Association. And I am an Oregon farmer and a third-generation Oregonian. Dave mentioned the Washington Rath and Prairie issue, where the housing developments come out and they eat up our farmland, and then we increase our population, then we start seeing advocacy groups now wanting to regulate the farming practices. Well, they did succeed in getting the burning banned in Washington. Now, coming from the seed business, we're seeing our farmers with a shortened grass seed rotation. Representative Halvey was indicating that everything's great, everything's fine, they're now seeing increased yields. I don't tend to agree with that. All's not well in Washington and Idaho. With a reduced rotation, they're on one-year rotation raising bluegrasses, which was a large part of that production area. They now have to deal with agricultural field rotations. Maybe you're not familiar from all of you from the agricultural standpoint, but if we plant a specific variety on that ground this year and harvest it next year, and then we've got to rotate off now, we start using up our ground. We start contaminating our fields, and that's what's happening in the basin area up in Washington right now. Used to be a premier bluegrass production area when burning was allowed. Now burning is banned. We're now in a cycle now. We're through 5 years, and we're now going back on that same ground and replanting other bluegrasses, and we're seeing contamination of different species occurring off types in the fields. The poania is a problem, and it's an annual bluegrass, and we've got a severe problem with that burning used to sanitize the fields on. Now we no longer have that available to us, and so we're having to try to do it chemically. While chemicals have some success, they're not near as successful as the burning, and they're much more costly in relationship to handling that part of the business. So we can't provide the high-quality turf in some cases that people or our professional users are demanding, such as whether it's the Super Bowl or whether we're on the World Cup soccer stadiums. They do not need poania, and we don't need annual ryegrass. We also have issues in the valley with rodents, and the same issues with poania and annual ryegrass are here in Oregon. We do need to keep our highly erodible lands available for burning so that we do not have to see them flow down the streams and into the rivers. prior to our burning tightening down the burning in Oregon in the last run, Oregon used to be viewed as the highest quality seed production in the world. I think we had an indisputable position there. Since we've tightened our burning issues, we've gone to chemicals instead of sanitation from burning, we end up seeing more contaminant. And I have to say, when I got into the business, Europe, we'd always use the European seed would be a contaminated product, and we could sell Oregon seed easily against those products. Today, I'm not sure I can make that statement because of the weed load that we've been bringing into our fields. And we also have a consideration with lack of burning. We have weeds that tend to predominate. And in our wetter areas down in the South Valley, we've got a contaminant called manna grass or Glyceria. That's cropped up over the last year because the biosecurity in Australia now has seized over 30 containers of Oregon grass seed going in there with this weed on there. And with burning would have helped keep that in check. And with our issues in export, and we export a large amount of this grass seed, we also have soil as an issue. And without burning, we do not, we have issues with rodents, and we're losing our chemical eradication for the voles. There's been restrictions there. Burning used to kill them and get the rodents out of there. Mexico, Japan, and Australia all have zero tolerance for soil. And when we've got mice out in the fields building mounds, we have soil on our seed, and we have difficulty with selling, exporting seed. In looking at also the competitive factor, Oregon's acres did increase, but I'm going to say and tell you that they're probably on a decline. We're facing some significant competition from other production areas in the grass seed industry. Canada and Minnesota areas are raising a significant amount of production that's leaving the valley because of issues that we have the contaminant in our seeds that burning would have eradicated. And today there's over 60,000 acres going to be harvested this summer up in Canada, which has been gone from basically zero 6 years ago. And it's at the expense of Oregon agriculture. So to be competitive in Oregon agriculture, we need the support of our residents in Oregon. But instead of banning burning, I would encourage us to actually look at opening up some of the burning because it's created a major economic issue and it's affecting our business. And if we don't do something of that nature and we continue to tighten it down, we just as well have our farmers go ahead and file more Measure 37 petitions and subdivide and plant houses. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Derek Schumacher.
Okay, we'll keep it relatively close if we want the other three people because we're getting down there now. And we have another committee coming in here at 5.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Greetings, Chairperson Roblin and committee members. My name is Derek Schumacher, and I'm employed at the Jacqueline Seed J.R. Simplot Company as a grower services field consultant, and I currently farm as well. I've worked in the seed industry 10 years and been involved in grass seed production all my life. I received a bachelor's degree in crop and soil science from Oregon State in 1997 and went on to get my master's degree in crop and soil science in 2005 from Oregon State as well. And I'm here to discuss my research thesis, which investigated residue management and yield characteristics of fine fescue seed crops. It was conducted under my major professor, Tom Chastain. The justification for our study was to seek alternative residue management of fine fescue seed crops. The objectives were to characterize differences in yield components of cultivars among different residue management treatments and to evaluate these cultivars and their responses to residue management treatments. Our procedure was we evaluated 10 commercially produced cultivars consisting of three subspecies of fine fescue, being Chewings fescue, strong creeping red fescue, and slender red fescue. Our cultural practices were typical of those used in fine fescue production in the Willamette Valley. Statistical analysis was done using SAS, analysis of variance and contrast. Our experimental design was a randomized complete block with a strip plot arrangement of treatments in four replications. Our main plots were residue management treatments. There were three of them, consisting of thermal, which mimicked open burning, non-thermal, which was rake, bale, and flailing stubble to 2.5 centimeters, and thirdly, non-thermal, which was rake, bale, and flailing stubble height to 5 centimeters. Our subplots were 10 fine fescue cultivars. Our yield component sampling and measurements taken consisted of fertile tiller number, spikelets per panicle, florets per spikelet, and panicle length, as well as total dry weight. Final seed yield and yield trends were evaluated, as well as an economic analysis was done based on a partial budgeting technique. Our 2003 results were that there was a net loss under non-thermal residue management ranging from $92 to $889 per acre. In 2004, we saw a net loss under non-thermal residue management ranging from $50 to $1,189 per acre, so pretty significant. Our treatment effects we saw in 2004 under thermal residue management, it significantly increased over non-thermal residue management with respect to total dry weight, spikelets per panicle, florets per spikelet, and panicle length. To conclude, thermal residue management is critical in maintaining profitable seed yield in fine fescue seed crops. Non-thermal residue management did not produce profitable seed yields as we hypothesized in this study. Therefore, it cannot be considered a viable alternative to thermal residue management. Without open field burning, Willamette Valley growers will not be able to produce fine fescue. Increased erosion will occur due to shorter rotations in steep terrain. This will have a direct effect on the economy in Oregon and will lead to increased housing development, such as in the Rathdrum Prairie in Idaho, where they have temporarily lost thermal residue management as a tool. It would be a shame to see House Bill 3000 pass based on short-term thinking with long-term consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. We're probably not going to be able to take the rest because there's another group that's waiting out here, but we want to thank you all for being here. And when this is over, we're going to need to exit that way. There's a huge crowd coming in that door, so I just wanted to let people know what was happening. We are going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3000. And anything else for our group? Seeing nothing, we're going to close our Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Thank you.